Right. So, yeah. Hello, everyone. I'm Nicola. I work with Laurent, and today we're going to talk about asymptotic charges in Maxwell theory. Let me start by saying that I'm gonna show you a bit of motivation, of context, the messages that I'd like to convey, then a bit of setup. I have actually four slides of notation, so bear with me. The notation is going to be important. The Maxwell equations, I will resolve the Maxwell equations, written in human penal formalism. Then their asymptotic expansion and gas-free charges. A result about the summation, hypergeometric functions. For now, I don't have any physical interpretation for it, but I can just show you the results. Something a bit more physical, interpretation of terms in terms of multiple for those asymptotic charges, and the prospect and what comes next. Okay, so first disclaimer is the fact that it's still very much a work in progress. So I don't have any final results to show you. But somehow, since it's also the context of this young PI researchers conference, I thought it was maybe a good opportunity to emphasize also the way we do research and in that case, the fact that the notation can really have an impact, and you start with something which seems maybe a bit old and boring and you know everything about it, namely the Maxwell's equation in Bayesian. And if you massage things well and if you introduce the correct notation, you can actually deduce something non-trivial.
And I'm very fine with questions. Now I speak too loud. I'm very fine with questions during the talk, so don't hesitate to interrupt. For the motivations and the context, since I'm working with Laurent, like the big framework is always this local holography program. So the basic ideas in gravity, one of the main the starting points, is the fact that when you consider asymptotically flat spacetime and the symmetries of asymptotically flat spacetime, you do not just get Poincaré, but you get something called the BMS group, and there are like even extensions of this BMS group. And this is an infinite dimensional symmetry group, and basically you have the translations that are no longer just a global parameter, but they can depend on the point on the celestial sphere, which is the sphere at infinity. Then it means that you can ask, because you always have to remember that as soon as you have symmetries, it means that you have conserved currents, and you can define charges, and those charges can be are generators for the representation of the symmetry at the quantum level. So it means symmetry is always a handle from classical physics to quantum mechanics. And obviously there can be subtleties, but it's still a very powerful tool. And in local holography, there is this word holography. So the idea is always to start with data on a certain boundary, and you try to recover information about the bulk. As I said, four slides of notation, just the setup. We're going to work in Minkowski space. We're going to use retarded coordinates. So this U, it's just T minus R. We use the stereographic coordinates on the sphere. So if you never heard about it, basically you just take your sphere, you cut it in half, you put a plane in the middle, and then you draw a line between, say, the North Pole and any point on your plane. And this also intersects the sphere, and it's the mapping between points on the sphere and points on the complex plane. defined with this Z and the complex conjugate Z bar. The metric has this form, and we use the Neumann-Penrose tetrads. So you like it's usual tetrads, but you take them to be null. So this K is basically a derivative with respect to time. This L, the vector L, is basically a derivative in the radial direction. And then you still have to parameterize the two. So those two guys are null, and you still have to parameterize your sphere. And in order to get also something null, the sphere, the tangent space of the sphere is spacelike, but to get something null also, you just, rather than taking d theta and d phi, you take the complex sum of the two and you get something which is also null, and you call it m and m bar. Okay, just for the notation of the metric. Another very important tool that we're going to use, and a peculiarity when you are in two dimension, is the fact that there is an isomorphism between the symmetric trace-free tensors and two scalars. So it's just a fact of dimension two and just a bit of combinatorics. So it means that rather than dealing with tensors and thus also covariant derivatives acting on that tensors and plenty of indices, you introduce a notation which is for any operator O. You have this mapping. You can define a scalar OS and a scalar O minus S. You call this S the helicity of the operator. And basically, you just take the operator and you project down either on M or on M bar. M bar is equal to 1. And you get those two scalars. So once again, it's a way to organize things. Rather than dealing with tensorial quantities, you deal only with scalars. And you can also introduce a derivative on that object. It's a very common thing in the tetrad formalism. It's called the intrinsic derivative. And basically, this D, O, which acts on the operator OS, it's just a DZ, and this D bar is just a DZ bar. And yeah, this intrinsic derivative operator has very nice properties. One of it is that the commutator of the two is diagonal, so it's proportional to the spin S of the operator. And the last one of the last thing that I, which is very nice also in this context of obtaining scalars quantity from tensors, is the fact that rather than using spherical harmonics in order to describe a function in the sphere, you can use spin spherical harmonics in order to describe a function on the sphere, which comes from a symmetric trace-free tensor. So it means this S is the same S as in the operator when you get your two scalars, and it works exactly as our usual spherical harmonics. And once again, those operators, D and D bar, they have very nice property. You see, it's just a coefficient times, it's a raising operator. The D is a raising operator now for this spin, exactly as in the usual angular momentum, where you have a raising operator for M. Now you have a raising and a lowering operator for this S. So once again, it's a very nice way to organize computations, rather than having plenty of covariant derivative on the sphere and no relation between things. Here you can classify. And last point, just the definition of phi 0, phi 1, phi 2, the so-called Neumann-Penrose scalars. You take F, you take the dual of F, so F tilde. You take the sum, the complex sum of the two. It's called the self-dual tensor. And you project that object on certain direction of the tetrad, and you get three different objects, phi 0, phi 1, phi 2. So you see it's just this combination of F and F tilde along certain tetrad. So nothing very fancy. If you now just take the Maxwell equations combined with the Bianchi identity, Maxwell equation d mu f mu equal to 0, no matter. Bianchi identity d mu f mu tilde equal to 0. You sum the two, you get d mu f mu plus the self-dual part equal to 0. You project those Yeah, there is only one free index. So you project along L, along M, along M bar, along K. You get four equations. Those are the Maxwell's equations combined with the Bianchi identity, but written in the Newman-Penrose formalism. And once again, very good notation, because you immediately see that the last two equations at the bottom are very similar to the first two. So it means that there is some sort of redundancy. And for instance, it means that once you know phi zero, you plug it in there, you get phi one. Once you get phi one, you also get phi two. So it means that basically almost everything up to details, but almost everything is incorporated in this phi zero. So very powerful way to organize things with those Newman-Penrose scalars. And okay, for instance, you can get a closed form for phi zero. And then there is the first ansatz. How do you solve those equations? So we are interested in, the behavior at infinity, the asymptotic behavior. We want to define some charges at infinity. So you have to impose some fall-off conditions for your fields. So remember, those phi are basically just the field strength. And there is only one condition to impose, a physical one. Phi one, in phi one, there is the electric field. You look at the components, it turns out that in phi one, there is the electric field. And when you take the electric field integrated on a sphere, what do you get? It's the Gauss law. So once again, the holographic principle. If you want to know the amount of charges in this room, you do not need to enter the room. You just need to pick the electric field, the value of the electric field at the boundary of the room. And so it means that a quantity that seems to be like living in the bulk is actually fully incorporated into data that are on the boundary of the system. And so here, electric field integrated on the sphere, you want something finite. So it means that at infinity, this guy must have a fall-off condition of 1 over r squared. And once you have a fall-off condition for phi 1, equations also dictate the fall-off for phi 0 and phi 2. And you plug this in equation 1, you get that thing. Why do I show this equation? Because first of all, notice that there is here an n plus 1 and here an n. So it means that there is some sort of a recursion relation between this phi zero at order n plus one and phi zero at order n. And notice, so that written that way, you cannot solve it immediately, but it's interesting to see that there is some sort of recursion relation. It's going to be important after. And notice that here it's a d bar d, here it's a dd bar. And one thing, again, which is obvious written that way using that notation, is the fact I said previously that the commutator of dd bar is proportional to the spin. And phi zero has spin one, because there is a projection along m. And we said you count plus one when it's projecting along m, and you count minus one when the quantity is projecting along m bar. So when you commute the two here, you get rid of this one here. And it's very important to have something proportional to n in the final equation, because it turns out, I also said that this d bar d is diagonal on the bay when it acts on a spin spherical harmonics. And I said that any function can be expanded in this spin spherical harmonic basis. So it means that those phi zero, they have components of precise angular momentum. And when you act with d bar d on a certain value of this angular momentum, you will precisely cancel that term. So it means that you will get something like du, and the du is a dt, like du of something is equal to zero. So it means that you found something which is conserved. So that's the first indication of a charge. And so I'm going to come back to that in just a minute. But first, I need to introduce this magical ansatz, which comes from also insight of gravity, because some work of gravity has been done before, actually some work in QED. And basically, if you do not have this amazing ansatz, I'm gonna explain a bit. You cannot simplify things, and it's really, once again, it, the way you define objects really does matter. So, okay, let me break down this formula. Your phi zero component n, you write it as d bar n qn plus one. This qn is just an object of spin n. So notice that I said that d bar is an operator that lowers the spin. So you indeed get something of spin one, and phi zero must have spin one. So that's fine. Why do you need this extra piece? Simply because this qn plus one, as I said, it has spin n plus one. And since now the L always has to be bigger than the spin, it turns out that this object is a sum of vector spaces of a definite spin and an angular momentum running from n plus one to infinity. But when you act now with the d bar, you lower the spin, but the d bar does not touch the L. So you have still a sum starting at n plus one. On the other hand, the phi zero is an object of spin one. So it means that the only condition on L is to be bigger than one. So it means that there is a mismatch between that quantity and the left-hand side. And you basically just call the mismatch phi zero G. G and L, it stands for global and local. Another piece of notation, don't really have the time to explain that, and it's not yet fully clear. So just take it as a label for the two pieces. So as I said, there is a certain piece in the equation that I showed before, this equation two. You select a certain piece and you get du of something which is equal to zero. So it means, first of all, that there is a conserved quantity. Physical meaning of that, as I said, still work in progress. Those charges, basically, at first, like the first one, it's just the electrical charges. What are all the others? Okay, still up to determined. But still, there is this idea of having charges, having a symmetry, having an algebra, and thus having a way to label quantum states. So that's always what you need to keep in mind. And the very important now feature of the equation that I showed before is the fact that it was written as one equation, but it was not one equation. It was one equation written in the bad notation. It's actually two equations when it's written in the correct notation. You have one equation for the global part, and you have one equation for the local part. And this one is exactly the same as the just with one coefficient on the other side, but it's exactly the same as the one that I showed before. But it splits now. Because of this condition, you have a split, and the local part now takes this form with this ansatz about this d bar, very important because you need once again to use the commutator of the two operators, d and d bar on the sphere, and everything cancels out. And without that type of ansatz, you have nothing. And you can also prove a nice piece of group theory and so on. You can also prove that this operator d bar is injective. So it means that when you have d bar of something equal to zero, the something is equal to zero. So it means that once again, this relation simplifies and you get something with a d bar to the power n, but actually no, you get something just du of our object q, which is once again some sort of a charge, because this equation, it looks like a continuity equation, an equation for the conservation, a dt of something, some kind of divergence of this other object at the order one less. So yeah, all those definitions to say that you have charges that naturally live on the celestial sphere. All those quantities are function of Z and Z bar. And it suggests a higher spin symmetry. once again, interpretation of that still work in progress. I don't have any final result to show you, but it seems to be the right way to proceed. And then you can even solve more. This phi zero global, it's even a polynomial in U, and everything is determined by those charges G that are conserved. And the local parts, kind of the same. You have an initial condition, this Q minus one. It's related to when you look at the, it's a component that appears in phi two, and phi two, the fall-off condition for the second, the Neumann-Penrose scalar phi two was one over R. So it means that it incorporates the radiative content of your spacetime. And if you first, for simplicity, but also for physical reason, if you first impose Q minus one equal to zero, it means that the relation for Qn is once again to be a polynomial. You have difference integration constant. By definition, they are integration constant, so they don't depend on U. It's only a function of Z and Z bar. So once again, you found a conserved charge, the little Qs that are associated to those big Qs, and they are just simply related by this polynomial in U. Why do I say that the Q minus one equal to zero, the no radiative case, is also physically motivated? It's because it's the simplest case. So it means that since you get conserved charges, it would mean that at the quantum level, you can maybe think that your Hilbert space is labeled by those, by the eigenvalues of those charges. And the non-radiative case would be kind of your vacuum. And then when you have radiation, you have maybe transition between two vacuum that are non-radiative. And those, once again, those transitions, they are labeled by exactly the quantum number associated to those charges. This is just a resummation of, I don't have any, just the final result. It's a long calculation, but just the final result, just to see that if you include the one over Rn terms, so if you resum the whole guys, the phi one minus s is simply the notation for the spin. You have phi zero, phi one, phi two, and if you include the spin, it goes like one minus s. And so it's true, like in general, as I said, if you determine phi zero, then you determine phi one, then you determine phi two. So you have very generic formulas for all the three. And so, yeah, when you incorporate, say, phi zero n r to the power n, you resum everything, and you have the global part entirely determined by this G global. So it's kind of amazing in also, I mean, like the final formula is entirely determined by your conserved charges. So it means, once again, the notation that has been introduced allows you to write a solution with that form. And you can do the same with the local part. But as I said, in that form, for now, we don't have any like physical intuition. This tau, it was on purpose that I wrote it in two different ways. This tau is exactly the minus u over 2r. Yeah. So what does it really mean? Why is it some u over r? Is it some sort of conformal time? Or we don't really know. But the more physical picture is this one, is the fact that those charges, the little q's, they are related actually to very well-known like objects that are multiples. When you have a scalar field, it can be in gravity, or it can be in Maxwell, doesn't matter. I mean, if you just consider the Newtonian potential, something in one over R, it can be expanding in Legendre polynomial and so on. And you have you have this kind of formula with a sum over all possible angular momentum, and the one over r to the certain power is totally fixed, and you have those objects ML that determine how your solution behaves on the sphere. And it turns out that it's indeed what we recover in the case of a scalar. This formula is written for a scalar. Phi 1 is the one with the spin 0, so it's a scalar. You exactly have this same formula, and you can also introduce an object EL, which is exactly also a monopole. And you see that this EL, the only thing to remember is the fact that it's once again totally determined by the little QPL, just mean certain angular momentum. Okay, that's the general picture, and there are still lots of details to work out and to extend. For instance, this analysis is done now on Square Plus, so with retarded coordinates. I have to do the same thing in advanced coordinates on Square Minus. Then there are notions of matching between the two. Is this multiple expansion valid in general? I did it for the scalar case, but then you can also consider vector spherical harmonics and vector multiple moments. So I still have to check that it's also, you also get this kind of nice formula in those cases. I need to include radiation. There are lots of parallel between QED and gravity. The formalism is very similar. That's the very little summary in one sentence. Also, sentence about gravity, the coefficient of those Newman-Penrose scalars expanding in 1 over r, and in particular, the psi 0 notation of gr, which in, it's one of the Weyl scalar, which encodes outgoing radiation, are identified with charges. They're generating asymptotic symmetries. So those Qs, little Qs, and also something which is called the soft theorems and the soft charges. It's a whole history. You can look at the Weinberg. There is something called the soft theorem for graviton. So yeah, it's related to a lot of other stuff. And then you can even extend what I did for ADS, DS, young males. Still a lot of work to do. Thank you. Go ahead.
I have one simple question that I arrived a little bit later, so maybe you said something about this in the beginning, but you said that electromagnetism is holographic. You said that if you come to this room by measuring the electric field on the walls, you can tell me what is inside. But if I put a positive charge here and I put a sphere of negative charges surrounding that, how can you tell?
No, for sure. It's it depends on the way you define your system and your subsystem. So the boundary, cannot be, as I said, there are ways to screen this effect. So I agree, but it's kind of the take home message to say that some information about something that happens in the bulk can be incorporated on the boundary. Just that it needs refinement, yeah, for sure. But it's just the global message.
So then, but still you expect to see some difference fundamentally between electromagnetism and gravity, because in electromagnetism you can screen charges, whereas gravity you cannot screen masses.
For sure, it's a very special case that everything is linear, and that as soon as you incorporate nonlinear behavior, things are more complicated and it's only a toy model. So do I expect, I would say yes, but I'm not gonna go out on a limb and say things I'm not really sure about, because as I said, it's still work very much in progress, and this whole little exercise project was inspired by gravity and was kind of a warm-up to then deal with gravity and Young Mills. And it turns out that there are still like non-trivial things to deal with and to massage in a sense. So I'm still working on that. But yeah, for the more gravity side, I still have to deal deeper with it.
Sorry, but I think we don't have time for another question.
Yes, sorry, I was.
Thank you so much for your talk.
Thank you.